This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's show, we're going to be talking about Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation, Vacation, Infinitely Polar Bear, a Lego Brickumentary, and the Stanford Prison Experiment. We'll also talk about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course, the world-famous DVD roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, this is how you reach me. You can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com and facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And of course, that Fat Guys at the Movies handle will also work on Instagram. But on Twitter, if you want to find me, you can find me directly at twitter.com/Kevin Carr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
I'm going to talk first off in the news section about the shooting that happened last week at the train wreck showing in Lafayette, Louisiana. I didn't talk about it last week. It was developing, and I wanted to step back and not be reactionary and sort of give my thoughts this week on that. First of all, this is not going to be a discussion about guns and gun control or gun ownership or the Second Amendment. If you want that discussion, go on your social media accounts because there's plenty of that discussion going on right now. I'm going to talk about how it impacts theaters and some of the questions that were raised. And as sickening as what happened in the movie theater was, it is almost equally as sickening watching the media, of which I'm a part, fall head over heels to try and make this significant to anything they talk about for no other reason than to get traffic or hits or viewers or listeners. The amount of vulturism that goes on after any event like this is sad. And it's gotten worse, I think, over the years because media has grown because there's now anyone can have a website and everybody's on social media. Very quickly after this happened, somebody had posted a story. I think it was Deadline was like, are we going to require metal detectors in movie theaters? And I'm like, okay, whoa, put on the brakes. This was one guy who was clearly disturbed, who went in and did a horrible thing. And true, there has been violence in movie theaters before. Colorado just convicted Holmes, the guy who shot up the Dark Knight screening 3 years ago. So people get this impression that this happens all the time. One nut job does not make a pattern. I go to movies all the time. I go see 4, 5, 6 movies a week. Now, granted, I see a bunch of them at press screenings, and some of them I see at public screenings, but I also go and pay money and get a ticket and go see it with other just regular people when they aren't screening a movie. Heck, I'm going to have to do that next week with Fantastic Four. So I go to movie theaters all the time. I take my kids to movie theaters all the time. And while you can expect to see some nut job try this again, because after the Dark Knight shooting, you had a couple copycat incidents happening, this is by no means a pattern. In the last 3 years, do you know how many people that I know have died in a movie theater from a shooting? I think, well, 4, because I think there was an incident where somebody got shot over using a cell phone several months ago. Then these 3 people, the 2 innocent victims and the guy who shot himself. Do you know how many people have attended a movie in the last year? I don't know the actual number, but I would imagine it's hundreds of millions of tickets sold for all movies over the last year. And only this small amount of people have suffered this kind of an incident. This is the very definition of a isolated, limited, rogue incident. So let's not start saying we need to have metal detectors at movie theaters. This could have happened at any public place. Could have happened at a street festival. Could have happened in a library. It could have happened at a mall. It could have happened at a sporting event. It could have happened anywhere. It just so happened that this guy decided to take his frustrations on the world out in this particular movie. I also don't think there's anything we can read into it being in a train wreck screening. I don't think he was lashing out necessarily at Amy Schumer. It was a big movie. It was a popular film. And he was had it in a handgun. I mean, this goes far beyond decked out with machine weaponry like Holmes was in Colorado. This guy just had a handgun. You can hide a handgun. Unfortunately, that's how things work. This kind of stuff can happen anywhere. And the sad fact is, there's no way to predict this necessarily. This is not an argument against guns or for guns. This is about some crazy person doing something terrible. You can't predict when. And the only thing you can predict is stuff like this happens. And that, not to minimize at all anything for the victims, not just the people who died and their families, but the people that got shot and had to spend time in the hospital and recover from this. I'm not minimizing their pain, but these kind of incidents have and always are going to happen. So the idea of putting us in some weird police state where we're putting in metal detectors, and how, who's going to pay for the metal detectors, and who's going to, look, I've been to movie theaters where they can barely keep the picture in focus. Do you think you're going to trust these people to scan and pat down patrons and check for weapons? As sad as this is and as horrible as this is that it happened, it is not a event that's likely going to repeat itself with any sort of frequency. And I'm still going to movies. That hasn't stopped me. It hasn't stopped me from taking my kids to movies. Because it's a percent of a percent of a percent of a percent. It's so tiny, and it's shocking and horrible, but it doesn't at all represent any behavior of anybody in a general sense. We're in a country of 300 million people. You're going to have a handful of crazies out there. That's terrifying, but that's just the way it is. There's no way to get rid of the crazies before they do something like this. So yes, my heart goes out to the families of the victims and the victims themselves. But this was an isolated incident, and we don't need to start talking about putting metal detectors in movie theaters. A couple other real quick pieces of news that are far less important to the general social structure, but are interesting nonetheless. Channing Tatum, there's a rumor that he's apparently going to be dropping out of the Gambit movie, which is interesting because it just got released this week that it's got a $150 million budget, which isn't very small nowadays compared to other movies. Another piece of superhero news is Chris Pine is not going to be Green Lantern in the DC Extended Universe. He's going to be in Wonder Woman as her love interest. And that's fine because they had to get somebody who was small enough that Gal Gadot could look like she was imposing on him. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is The 33, which opens on November 13th.
Is that the only way in?
The only way in, the only way out.
How much longer?
About an hour.
We may be looking at a weakness in the mountain's internal structure.
She's an old mine.
It's my job to keep this man safe.
This looks like basic Oscar bait end of the year stuff. There's a lot of people in this movie who look like they're doing it because it's the right thing and they might get an Oscar nomination. I don't know. We'll see. November 13th, that's right in the beginning of award season's push, and it's a significant human spirit kind of nonsense movie. We'll see how well it is. It's all about the acting and the writing and the directing for the people down there, and if you can actually stretch it out and make it look significantly harrowing. The next one I want to talk about is 13 Hours, which is Michael Bay's take on the Benghazi crisis. It opens on January 15th.
We need immediate assistance. We are overrun.
States under attack. Let's go, man. States under attack.
Let's go. We gotta move.
If you do not get here soon, we are all gonna die.
You have a U.S. ambassador at risk.
The ambassador is in his safe haven. You're not the first responders. You're the last resort. You will wait.
None of you have to go. We are the only help they have.
I'm just going to go out on a limb, and I think this is going to be a bad movie. And the reason is because it's Michael Bay. He had a chance to try and do some serious filmmaking, some not goofy, stupid filmmaking with Pain and Gain, and I think he failed miserably on that. I'm not talking about box office. I'm talking about the fact that he was trying to do a serious take on something, and he still couldn't break out of being 12-year-old child making fart jokes, essentially. He has no depth of thought. His stuff looks amazing and looks incredible, but even if you watch this trailer, if you watch it on the internet, it looks like he's edited exact shots from his other movies, like Pearl Harbor, into this trailer. And then you listen to the trailer and it sounds like Transformers are attacking. This looks like it's going to be a Transformers movie without robots. Plus, it's in January. That's usually a bad sign. And then finally, 13 Hours is probably not just the title of the movie. It's also probably the running time because it's Michael Bay. That's it for right now. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Vacation and a Lego Brickumentary. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr coming back with Fat Guys at the Movies, getting ready to take our final vacation of the summer. My wife's a teacher, and so we get the summers off. I don't go to an office every day, so my work is somewhat unconventional. And of course, the kids are home for the summer, and my wife's home for the summer, so it's long, this one long extended weekend from June through August. And ironically, we actually took a vacation during this past week. We took a little mini vacation, did a little bit of a road trip. And I'll tell you, there is nothing that will make your family bond better or kill each other faster than locking everybody up in a steel prison about 3 feet from each other and then flying down the road at 80 miles an hour. Let's just play the trail real quick. Rusty Griswold from the original Vacation movies has grown up and decides to drive his family cross-country to visit Wally World.
Wally World? Here we come.
They see me rolling.
Ah! It looked like somebody blew their head off. Freeze!
This trip's been a nightmare.
You had a dream to take your family to Wally World. Never let that go.
What kind of a family are you?
We're the Griswolds!
We're naked and covered in human waste.
Oh, come on, sweetheart. We don't know that it's human.
Now, I've done the big vacations, and I've done the road trip across the United States. So it's interesting because I'm watching this. There's a scene in this movie that's in Four Corners, which I've been to. And there's a scene going through the Grand Canyon. I've been there. We've been to a lot of these places. And that's significant because part of the charm of the original Vacation movie, the National Lampoon's Vacation that came out over 30 years ago, was that Chevy Chase was just this very zealous father who just wanted to get his kids and family out on the road and take this monumental, memorable trip. His heart was in the right place, and he was doing it for his family. And of course, like any kids, sometimes they go, I don't care about this. But then they do remember the stuff later on. Part of the charm of that original movie, and even European Vacation to a degree, and Christmas Vacation, was the fact that the family was a good family. They have surly teenagers, but teenagers can be surly. And they weren't mean-spirited. And they got around that because everybody they encountered along the way was crazy and mean-spirited at times, or really insane, like dangerously insane, like Cousin Eddie, which is played by Randy Quaid and his family. And there was a certain grounding in reality for the original Vacation movie because, like I said, I've done this. I've taken my family across country in a station wagon, quite literally. I know exactly what this is like. And you see some weird things and you run into some really weird people. It is an experience and it is eye-opening. And there's so many people who don't leave their hometown, or if they go somewhere, they fly and they go from New York to LA and they fly over the country. You need to drive through the small towns. You need to stay in the crappy motel rooms. You need to get on the highway. You need to stop at the rest stops. You need to go see the Corn Palace in South Dakota. You need to stop and say, hey, look, there's a house made out of fossilized dinosaurs. You need to drive through the Southwest and say, what are these billboards for The Thing? And then stop at this crummy little rest stop and pay $5 to go see a really bizarre museum. That is, in a lot of ways, the heart and soul of this country. And that's what the first movie plays off of. This one, it's like they're trying to make a Vacation movie, but they didn't understand what made the first Vacation movie work. In this Vacation movie, the characters are not appealing. And the characters are crazy in the original, but it's just Clark Griswold, Chevy Chase's character, he's just so excited to do this. And he doesn't realize that his family's hating it in the process. But and while they don't always get along, they don't get along the way a family does. In this movie, like, for example, they got this young kid. And the young kid just swears, and he's abusive, and he's mean. I mean, like, dangerously mean and destructive to his older brother. And the parents are just like, oh, don't worry about it. And I can't summon any amount of sympathy for a character like that, because the character's an awful person. I cannot get behind characters that are awful people. I just can't. I'm sorry. I've never been able to. Unless you're watching, and I've said this before, because I said this a couple weeks ago about Trainwreck. Unless you're watching a movie that's fun to watch their lives fall apart, I can't get any sort of sympathy for them. And that's what I didn't like about this one. And Ed Helms, while he's funny, he doesn't really nail the character, because he's so aloof and so stupid sometimes that I don't have any sympathy for him. And then there's a bunch of stuff that, I guess in a vignette structure, if you take it scene by scene, they're funny, but they don't fit together. And there's things where they're really obviously going for a joke, and you're like, yeah, I get it. That is really dumb. And it stretches the joke so far, it just doesn't work. And I'm all for crass comedy. I love bathroom humor as much as the next guy. I do. I love bathroom humor. But you can't just show poop on screen and expect people to laugh. Just as you can't make a 10-year-old kid swear with no originality to it and make that funny. That's not funny. You have to do something clever. And in fact, in one of the movies I'm going to be talking about later, Infinitely Polar Bear, there's a scene where this young girl drops a swear word, and I'm like, that's hilarious, because it was unexpected and it was funny. When they do it with this movie, they're like, oh my gosh, we need a laugh. Let's have the little kid swear. It's not very well constructed. And these are the guys who are writing Spider-Man. The guys who directed this are writing Spider-Man. So what's this world coming to? Anyways, Vacation kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about a Lego Brickumentary. The history of the famous Danish toy company is examined from its humble inception to its international creative expression.
What started as a Danish endeavor in 1916, it became a global phenomenon.
But it really captured the imagination of people of all ages.
It's become a monster brand of the toy business.
I spend over six figures annually just on Lego.
It's a creative tool.
It's a way that people are expressing themselves.
It's creating energy.
It's a language.
There is an adult fan community.
Geeks, weirdos, people like me.
It's not what's on the front of the box. You can actually create whatever you want out of this toy.
I'm sure there's a lot of people that have seen the poster of it, which is just the Lego face, and kids are immediately going to be like, Lego movie sequel. It's not a Lego movie sequel. Yeah, there's a little bit of, there's a Lego guy narrating it, Jason Bateman as a Lego guy. But it's not a Lego movie thing. You're not going to get Chris Pratt and Everything is Awesome and the bizarre Batman animation. This is a documentary. So don't take your kids expecting it to be a sequel to the Lego movie and then be like, it's Lego, I should love it and it should entertain my child. No, it's not going to, I mean, a little kid's not going to care. Like, you take a six-year-old who liked the Lego movie, they're going to be bored with it. It's a documentary, but it's a great documentary. It shows how the company started and how it grew over the years. And I remember, because I'm in my 40s, I remember playing with Legos long before they became as popular and as notable as they are today. This is before they really started doing the media crossovers. And it shows how the company went through ups and downs. And it shows, one of the things that's inspiring about it is it shows how people have made careers out of Legos, not just by joining the Lego company, although that's in there, but it also shows how people created their own jobs out of Legos, so to speak. There's an artist who does modern art in the form of Legos. There's a guy who designs architecture using Legos. There's street artists that use Legos. It's kind of amazing how this works. And it's very inspiring, because I've always said, you don't have to just push pencils at a crappy job. Do what you want to do. Find out what you're excited about. And if you love playing with Legos, doggone it, this movie is proof that you can find a way to make a living playing with Legos. So I'm going to have to say the Lego Brickumentary totally rocks. It's a great movie. It's totally worth watching, and it's very inspiring.
It rocks.
Excellent! Yay!
That's it for the segment. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation, and Infinitely Polar Bear.
Everything is awesome. Everything is cool when you're part of the team. Everything is awesome. When we're living out our dream.
there's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's hit the big movie, which is probably going to be the huge movie of the week, and that is Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. Ethan Hunt and the IMF team try to take down the Syndicate criminal organization.
Mr. Chairman, the time has come to dissolve the IMF. It's not just a rogue organization. It is a disgraced one.
Shutting down the IMF is a mistake you may regret.
The Syndicate is real, and they know who we are.
You need cooling!
A rogue nation, trained to do what we do.
An anti-IMF.
They're coming after us with everything they've got.
I kind of agonized over that explanation of this movie because I've seen all five now, Mission Impossible movies. So I'd seen all four of these. I haven't gone and revisited Ghost Protocol, which came out 4 years ago. But I loved Ghost Protocol. It was one of my favorite movies of that year. I thought it was a fantastic film. And of course, the other ones, I think the only one I've ever rewatched, even remotely recently, was the first Mission Impossible a couple years ago. And I have to admit, when I watched this movie, I didn't quite know what was happening. And it's not that it's complicated. I mean, I'm the guy who was telling people a couple months ago that it's not hard to follow what happens in the Terminator movie. You just have to pay attention and understand how time travel works in Hollywood. But I'll be honest with you, it was a lot easier to follow Terminator than it was to follow this movie. Why? Because it kind of takes off where the last movie left off. And supposedly there's this evil syndicate, which is a ghost organization, a rogue nation, if you will, that is working against the IMF. And Ethan Hunt, being Tom Cruise, and his team are trying to uncover that. They're trying to prove that they exist, and then they're also trying to take them down. And there's a lot of intrigue, and this person involved with this, and double-crossing, and back and forth, and there's a lot of that happening. But you kind of just have to stop trying to think about what's happening and let the movie take you where it goes, because the only purpose of this movie is to get from action sequence to action sequence. In that sense, it's a heck of a good time. I mean, you know what it reminds me of, because I recently rewatched The Man with the Golden Gun, which is a James Bond movie from the 70s. And the reason I rewatched it is because Christopher Lee's in it, and Christopher Lee recently passed away. It's a really good comparison to this movie because the Mission Impossible films have kind of become the American version of James Bond. And if you especially go back to those James Bond movies in the Roger Moore era, the plots weren't great. You know, even a movie that has a really good plot, which is For Your Eyes Only, where he's trying to find a nuclear code device, it's still just a MacGuffin to get him from chase sequence to chase sequence to sex scene to chase sequence. They don't do the sex scenes in this movie. They have a sexy lady in it, and boy, she's sexy, and they really like showing her bum. That would, of course, be Rebecca Ferguson, who's a very attractive woman, and she's got a great body, but yeah, they linger on her bum, like, alarmingly a lot, which, to me, I'm okay with it. I can take a lot of bum lingering, but I'm like, wow, there's another butt shot from her. And don't get me wrong, she's got a great caboose. But it just seemed like Christopher McQuarrie, who is the director, just was really fixated on that. So what's driving this? There's a guy they're chasing who's supposedly head of the syndicate or involved in the syndicate. That's all you really need to know, because it's just going from city to chasing to chasing. And let me tell you, the chase scenes are phenomenal and the stunts are amazing. And I know there's been a lot being said about Tom Cruise doing his own stunts. And as I understand it, he does a good number of them. I'm sure that if things get really, really dangerous, they replace him. But also there's going to be special effects done. And I remember when Iron Man 3 came out, and they have that scene where they all jump out of Air Force One. And they shot real people falling from the planes, but they replaced everything else. They replaced the sky. They could have done it in front of a blue screen because they completely replaced the background in that movie. The first scene, which is on the poster, so it's not really a spoiler, with him hanging off the side of a plane, that's really Tom Cruise. And, you know, good for him. He's 50 and he's doing that, which is impressive. But going to a finer point, there is a lot of really cool scenes. There's like a, you know, motorcycle chase, and you see all this in the trailers, and there's car chases and foot chases. I don't see any real noticeable digital effects. And this is becoming pretty cool to watch. If you have a motorcycle spinning past traffic, it's actually a real motorcycle spinning past traffic. And I'm sure there's some manipulation done digitally, but it looks great. And this is some great action. This is a huge step up from Jack Reacher, which was McQuarrie's latest film with Tom Cruise. But he works as Ethan Hunt. This is the fifth time he's done it, and it works. And they finally got the team gelled together. And of course, you've got Simon Pegg back, and of course, you've got Ving Rhames there. You've got Jeremy Renner behind the scenes. Of course, it's an ego piece for Tom Cruise, but it's a fun movie. And I'm not going to say it's my favorite of them, because I have to say, I think I like Ghost Protocol better. And inevitably have the scenes where we're all sitting down and they're saying, well, what do we have to do next? What do we have to steal? Or where do we have to go? Or who do we have to kidnap? Or whatever they're doing. They're saying, what are we going to do? And they start talking and you just kind of buzz out and they're like, blah, 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 blah. Action scene starts next. So yeah, I'm going to have to say Mission Impossible Rogue Nation rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about a smaller movie, is Infinitely Polar Bear. In the 1970s, a man with bipolar disorder struggles to raise his children while his estranged wife goes back to school for a chance for a more lucrative career.
My father was diagnosed manic depressive in 1967. He met my mother and told her all about his nervous breakdowns. She didn't care.
Why can't Daddy live here with us?
Daddy's still recovering from his breakdown.
He's a way better cook than you.
So they got married and they had me.
Oh.
And then my sister.
I got into Columbia.
You can't take the girls to New York.
Here's my proposal.
We love you.
Bye.
You move in with the girls and you take care of them.
Me?
We're already starting to get these early award films in the summer coming out. I know they got the Woody Allen movie coming out soon, but Infinitely Polar Bear is one to watch. Mark Ruffalo plays this guy and he's bipolar, which is where the title comes from. These kids don't know what that means, saying you're bipolar. So she refers to him as a polar bear. It also takes place in the 70s. So like now, there's a lot more learned about bipolar disorder, and there's a lot more learned with the medication that somebody with bipolar disorder goes through. It's written and directed by a woman named Maya Forbes, and it's partially autobiographical. It feels that way because you're like, I'm watching this, I'm going, well, movie in the 70s, so she'd be in her 30s or 40s, and definitely told from this girl's point of view of how this is all happening and how it affects her. So it does feel like it has that personal touch to it. What I like the most about this movie is it didn't demonize really anybody. It didn't demonize Mark Ruffalo's character, who's the one suffering from bipolar disorder. It didn't show him as an absolute basket case. It showed him as a guy who had trouble controlling himself. And because it takes place in the 70s, there was limited medication for bipolar disorder and limited understanding. You know, it was the whole thing where he doesn't want to take his meds, which still happens today. But it's not like he was dangerous, and it's not like he was a real problem. It's just he couldn't really effectively take care of himself. Doesn't demonize his wife, and they're estranged, they're living apart, and they're still trying to raise their kids. So it's not saying this permanency of separation, but it's also not trying to show that it's happily ever after, which is cool because that's the way the world is. So if somebody's suffering from bipolar disorder, they're not going to immediately just get better with a snap of the fingers or anything like that, no matter what kind of medication you throw in them. It also doesn't demonize the girls. The girls are bratty. The girls are nice. They're sweet. They're lovable, but they've also have their own problems. They're human beings. It really shows people struggling with the situation that they're in and dealing with some of the crap that's thrown at them. And that's reality. And I think this is one of the most real movies out there because he has to take care of the kids. It also shows the struggles that you went through if you're a dad trying to take care of your kids in the 70s. And if the mom wasn't, the mom would be judged and the dad would be considered incompetent. And let me tell you, I've raised my kids. I've got three kids. I've got a 7-year-old. He's my youngest, but I have a 14-year-old. And I remember in the early 2000s, I would still get weird looks. It shows how people have such a skewed traditional view of gender roles even today. or 10 years ago when I really was facing this. So I thought that there was a lot of truth in it. And that's one of the reasons that I really connected with the movie. So Infinitely Polar Bear totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. And when I come back, I got one more movie to review: The Stanford Prison Experiment, The Box Office, and the world famous DVD Roundup. Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Back, guys, at the movies with Kevin Carr coming at you for the final segment. We've got one more film to talk about, and that is The Stanford Prison Experiment. In the summer of 1971, a professor at Stanford University made a mock jail with the students to study the effects of prisons on its populations.
All right, gentlemen, we're going to have ourselves a lot of fun.
Rule number one, prisoners must remain silent.
This is an exercise period.
Okay, is it just me, or are these guys taking this thing a bit too seriously?
Why don't you give me 20 push-ups?
Look at this guy. Thinks he's John Wayne or something.
You address me as Mr. Correctional Officer.
This might be an interesting 2 weeks after all.
I first heard about the Stanford Prison Experiment when I was a little kid, and it was years after it took place. So maybe, I mean, it may have been 7, 8, 10 years after it took place in the early 80s. There was a show called That's Incredible, and I remember watching that, and it was a news magazine show featuring cool things. And they talked about the Stanford Prison Experiment in there. And I always found that fascinating, and I always thought about it, but I never really read much about it. It sort of just fell into the cracks in the back of my mind. And I'd always been aware of it. But then I heard that they were making this movie. So, this would be interesting. And as I do a lot of times, I try not to go in knowing too much. I don't like to read accounts, true accounts of what happened for a movie that's being made. Occasionally, I will see the original movie of something if it's a remake. Kind of want to go in fresh. I like the idea of seeing something with a complete blank slate, which is why when I previously talked about Infinitely Polar Bear, I didn't know anything about Maya Forbes, who directed and wrote it. I went in blind, which is always kind of interesting. It's a great way to experience movies, and it brings me closer to the average person, because most people don't care who was the writer or director. Anyway, so I knew about this prison experiment, but I didn't know the details of it, and it was interesting seeing them revealed, and it's very truthful to it. The movie does, as from what I understood, because I went home and read about it later, from what I understood, it was pretty accurate on how things went down and how they chose the participants, how they set up the jail, how the interaction within the prison and behind the scenes, how that went down. A little bit of creative license, I'm sure, is taken, but overall, it seemed pretty accurate to what happened. I find it fascinating, not because it's necessarily damning to prison populations and prison as a whole. I found it interesting as a way to look back almost 45 years later and see if this was a good experiment. And from what I understand, no, it's not. It was actually a terrible experiment. It was shoddy at best. There was very little context given, and everybody knew going in that they were playing a part. They knew they were not real prisoners. And while they did sort of react a certain way, they were not real prisoners. And these were not real guards. And in fact, one of the guys who was one of the most sadistic guards there was essentially playing a role. He was playing the character from Cool Hand Luke. He wasn't being normal. He was playing a role, and he was doing his own experimenting to see how far he could take it. And while it certainly gave some interesting depth to it, it completely complicates the entire situation, but it makes the experiment completely invalid. I really don't think there's any real science that you can take from that experiment. And this movie reveals it because it shows all the problems that were in the experiment and all the setup and how it was poorly conceived kind of from the beginning. But it still made it an interesting movie because if anything, I think it shows not what happens in real prisons because it wasn't a real prison and they didn't have an experience like they were in a real prison. But I think it shows how people will compromise their actions when they're being watched. This actually, I think, has more to say about how people react when they're given a role to play and how they act when they're told things are a certain way, but are done without any sort of context to it. And one of the parts in it, like there's a scene in there where the guards were losing control of the prisoners. And the warden, who was the professor, said, well, you're the guards, take care of it. And that's when things really got bad. I actually went to school. I have training as a teacher in high school. And I've seen high school classes devolve into a mess when there's a teacher or a student teacher who is inexperienced. Things can escalate so fast if you're put in charge of people and you don't know how to control them. I think this, if anything, it shows that people with no experience will usually go to the worst place possible. Again, I've watched that happen in high schools. I've watched that happen in camp, like camp counselors who aren't good at what they do, or just inexperienced. There's a reason why you need people with experience to do things and to train people, and you got to have the on-the-job training. They just kind of threw these guys into this experiment and let them devour each other. So it's an interesting movie. It's a fascinating film. And I think it pulls back the veil on certain things about human nature, but not necessarily what you think it's going to be saying from any sort of prior knowledge of the actual experiment that happened. So I'm going to say that the Stanford Prison Experiments just barely kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Last week, I predicted boldly that Pixels was going to get $50 million. It didn't even come close. It didn't even get half that, which is kind of disappointing. Because Pixels is a fun movie, I gotta say. Every summer, we get a slate of movies that don't do well. And we are always facing movies that underperform, and there's always the big summer movies that don't do well. Terminator is a great example of that. Terminator did not do well. Pixels did not do well. Of course, you got Jurassic World that's doing all sorts of business and Inside Out, which is doing all sorts of business and Ant-Man, which is okay. Ant-Man's not doing bad. Ant-Man ended up taking the weekend with just under $25 million, which isn't a huge number for Marvel movies, but it'll absolutely do. I still think that this is on track to being $300 million plus worldwide. It's only been out for 2.5 weeks. So Pixels did not do well. And I have to say, as much as I like the movie, and as much as I think it was unfair for people to judge Adam Sandler for making this movie and assuming it's going to be like everything else, I think his presence in it did hurt the movie. And here's why. Most people just haven't gotten over that string of terrible movies he made from about 2009 until 2012. You cannot, as a star, make crap so consistently that people always expect crap, because you will alienate most of your audience and the people that like you will eventually just get bored. You can't produce the same thing inevitably. I mean, even the Three Stooges went through changes in their lives and late into their years. Once they got into the 50s, their stuff, while it was popular, their classic stuff, their new stuff wasn't nearly as good. And I think that's what happened with Pixels is Adam Sandler, while his last couple films haven't been bad, his name has been so dragged through the mud by his own doing that people are just tired of his stuff. So I think that's what happened with Pixels. Southpaw came in at number 5 with $16.7 million, which isn't very good. And Paper Towns did 12.5, which also isn't very good, especially compared to how well The Fault in Our Stars did last year. That leads me to Mission Impossible. This week, I think that's going to top with $70 million. That's a little higher than most people are saying, but here's the thing. It's kind of opening in a vacuum. The top movie was less than $25 million last week, so Ant-Man's going to be well under $20 million this week. That just leaves a massive vacuum for Mission Impossible as the big summer movie to come in and do pretty well. I'm not going to say it's going to be like Jurassic World, but I also think, conversely, Vacation's not going to do terribly well. It had soft numbers during the week. I do not think it's going to end with much more than $20 million for the 5 days. It's in for a rough haul. And the only thing that's going to save it is that it's a lot cheaper than something like Pixels. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous DVD roundup. Couple quick ones I want to hit. First of all, we've got Home, the animated film from DreamWorks. Cute thing about an alien trying to get a girl back to her mom. It weirdly swerves into massive issues like genocide, but it doesn't talk about those. White God is also out there. I've not seen it, but apparently it's a pretty disturbing movie about stray dogs that rebel against humanity. It's a foreign film, I think from Hungary. The Water Diviner, which of course stars Russell Crowe in an Australian Academy Award winning film. And then my favorite pick of the week is Mystery Science Theater 3000, Volume 33. You've got Daddy-O, which is a great teens in trouble drama. And it's one of the early Joel episodes. You got Teenage Crime Wave, another teens in trouble movie, which seems to be one of the staples outside of their bug-eyed monsters and cheesy horror flicks. Earth versus the Spider, which is probably the weakest one of the bunch because it's in the eighth season, and that was always very rocky. That's the first Sci-Fi Channel season, but it's with Mike, and it's a great like classic B movie about a giant spider attacking a town. And then finally, Agent from Harm, which is a wannabe spy movie that was meant to be a TV series from the 60s. And it's, of course, it's low budget, so it couldn't be anything close to a James Bond movie. Another Mike episode later in the run, so he had gotten his footing in with the new cast. That is it for me. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Fantastic Four, Shaun the Sheep, Ricky and the Flash, and The Gift. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.